once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English debt.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Wow. I think we did that better than we've done it in 23 years.
You say that every week.
No, I don't say 23 years.
No, not every week.
You broadcast 23 years, and what do you get?
Another day older and deeper in debt.
You got it. Well, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of the radio program, which you may have noticed if you're listening. If you're not listening, you won't know that at all.
All they have to do is read the credits at the end of the radio broadcast.
They can. They can do that, yeah. And it's also the name of an SEC registered investment advisor whose regulatory agency is the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. See, that way it doesn't sound like they're approving or disapproving.
Because they're not.
They're just a regulatory agency.
They're just like, yep, you registered with us, and now we can get you if you do something wrong. Well, not that they couldn't do it before, but now we volunteered for it.
Yeah, and they can come and they can listen and do stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway, see, I totally lost my train of thought. Okay.
Yeah, we talked about the SEC.
The SEC. And this is, wait a minute. This is not investment advice, even though the name of the program and the two guys on the program are both, the same as the ones who work at the investment advisory firm. This is not investment advice on this program. This is educational information. See, the words don't, it's educational information. So that's cool. And, because investment advice is something given to people when they have given their taking into account their personal goals and tolerances and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. And then, we advertise on KTEM, but they don't pay us for the show. And we advertise for the show. Go figure that one out. And we don't pay them for the show and they don't pay us for the show.
Right.
Well, it's not really a show. It's a
program.
There
is no quid pro quo, Senator.
I'm not sure if there is or not. It's very complicated. Anyway.
There was no controlling legal authority.
That's true. Well, there is. Yeah, actually, the SEC. the information we present on here has been obtained from sources we believe to be reliable and accurate. However, we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of the information we deem to be. We should say deem there. We deem.
I just like saying deem.
Yeah,
I deem a lot of things.
And
but
we don't guarantee or warranty that the information we present here is complete or totally accurate or even accurate. We don't deem nothing.
Wait, that's a double negative.
You got it.
So if you
got it,
if you did that double negative two more times, we'd be doing it again.
We'd be deeming like mad.
You'd be redeeming.
Oh yeah.
Whoa.
And then we get a redemption.
Ah!
Boy, that sounds... We could do redemption
talks.
We
are such nerds. We are nerds about words. We're nerds about the market. We're
nerds about...
Are you
trying to say we're word nerds?
Yes, we were joking with Ed on his way out that we thought that the Bulls would win the Super Bowl this year because that's the nerds that we are. We really... You made a comment of...
Well, I can deem something here.
Go ahead and deem it.
I deem that the Bulls will not lose in the Super Bowl.
Okay. I think the accuracy of your prediction the accuracy of your deeming is probably true to the thousandth decimal point, but there could be some chance that causes it to be wrong.
Certainly.
Because it just seems right that the team of the Bulls should play in the Super Bowl.
It does. It seems right.
It just seems right to me.
But they should play against the Bears.
Yeah, that's what we're talking about.
The Bears,
the Bulls and the
Bears. And that's the essence of the story is the Bulls and the Bears, if they played, who would win? And the answer is it depends on which court they're playing, on which game they're playing, and where they're playing.
Which rules are being followed?
Yeah.
And that's true in the market.
That's true.
Because people say, are you a bull or a bear? And I'm like, why do you have to be just one? You need to be able to determine based on the venue what's going on at any given moment to say whether or not you're a fan of a bull or a fan of a bear.
That's true. Well, the markets did do something this week, even though it was a weird week that was half in one year and half in another year. So it was a biannual week, which has caused me a lot of consternation when trying to write about it.
Biannual week.
Yeah, because
this is like having your house be in two taxing vicinities for the taxes.
I've been sort of that way. It was actually on a field doing astronomy during astrophotographs that was bisected by a time zone. I mean, the time zone goes down the middle of the field, which means the GPS was stuttering back and forth between to knowing what time it was. And
was then, your watch as well? Every time you stepped across, was your white
no,
watch
I,
changing?
No, I didn't have an iWatch at the time. So I was, but the GPS system on the telescope mount was very confused as to what day it was. And then it got worse because one of the nights I was doing the astrophotography, we had the time change. So we had a time change on a time zone. So there were four possible times it could be at any
given
moment.
This is like Y2K squared.
It was really cool, but took me a long time to figure out which photograph came first, second, third, and fourth. But other than that, I loved it, though.
So this week...
That was called indeterminacy.
We had a strange week in the market with lots of growth and then lots of shrinkage until we ended out...
Well, actually, the S&P 500 lost 0.16% for the week.
Wow.
And
that sounds exciting.
It actually went up.
In 2019. It was up.
Not 1920.
The whole week of 2019, it was up. But so far, the week of 2020, it's down.
Which is an inauspicious augury for 2020. Do you like that? Inauspicious augury. That was cool.
Seeing as you use the same root in auspicious and augury.
Yeah. Was inauspicious augury. Anyway, so what happened was... You'll have to forgive us. It's a new year. We're still giddy. But for the trailing 30 days, it's up 2.83%. For the trailing 3 months, a 9.58% and 28% from last year's opening. Of course, now it's also good to remember, and I've said this several times in different ways, and if you've already heard it, please forgive me, but I think it's important to recognize that 28 or 30.4, if you measure for the calendar year, rise in the S&P 500 price is misleading, very misleading, because in the quarter, we had almost a 20% drop in the market in December, and then it came back up a little bit before the end. But for the month, for the quarter, the fourth quarter of 2018, the market lost like 16%. And so if you then... Because of the way statistics and percentages work, you can't just make 16% and break even. You have to make like 18% to break even. So the end result, rather than going through all the math, is if you take into account the drop at the tail end of 2018, you subtract that out of the gains for 2019, and the market was only up 11%. I say only 11%, that ain't half bad, particularly when you consider that earnings in the S&P 500 were up 0.1%. For the year, by the best estimates. We don't know the fourth quarter earnings yet, but the estimates are right now that it was up about 0.1% for the year, but the market went up 11%, which is what happens, by the way, just for the record, at the end of bull markets. The earnings begin to tail off. Manufacturing begins to decline. Typically, the consumer keeps on spending like Wile E. Coyote running off of a plateau. They just keep on spending like mad as the economy begins to unwind. And the market forgets about earnings, which supposedly drives the market price of the S&P 500 and the other indices. And it just keeps on going up. And this is classic 1999. Now, whether 2000 and 2020, or I like to say 2020, by the way, a little different way, MMXX, it's easier to understand than 2020.
Yeah, it sounds like you're talking about like motocross or something, though, when you do that.
Yeah, but in Roman numerals, it's so cool. MMXX. Yeah, this is really cool.
Doubled up on two things. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm looking forward, actually, to February 2nd.
Well, not February 20th?
Well, February 20th would be cool, but 2-2-2020 is going to be cool, but 2-20-2020 will be...
We need a 20th month, then we'd have 2020-2020. But that
we had a 10-10-10.
Yeah, I remember that.
And we had a 12, 12, 12, but after that, we got to wait another century to get the right month in there.
Why are we talking about this? There's actually a method to the reason. It sounds like we just walked down a rabbit trail in our conversation.
I think we squirreled down a rabbit trail.
Yeah. Indexes falling into round numbers have the same, for some reason, the same draw of public attention as when your odometer passes 100,000 miles, or there's something about round numbers that people like.
Well, that's because of the number of fingers we have. Counting the thumbs.
Wait a minute.
Count the thumbs.
Do you have round fingers?
We have a round number of fingers.
Oh, okay. All right. There's going
to
be
you have to count the thumbs as fingers, which some people don't do. And there's a great debate over whether a thumb is actually a finger or it's a separate entity.
Yes. So the idea here on these big round numbers, it's a big headline. For some reason, people really like round numbers in the market.
And 2020 will be a significant year, I think, because of the number of fingers and toes we have.
Oh, okay.
Because we have 20 fingers and toes. Again, counting thumbs as fingers.
You speak for yourself. I know that there are people out there that have more and less than what you're saying.
But they're outliers.
I wouldn't be insulting like that. Shame on you.
They're definitely not in the bell curve. And since we have 20 fingers and toes and the year is 2020, this should be a significant year.
Your logic is impeccable.
Depends on which calendar you're using, though. But that's the
if you're using fingers and toes to count with, you're probably not using a calendar.
I don't know. I'm probably. Hey.
We're in a goofy mood today.
Do you know where the term bean counter came from?
I could make a guess, but I don't know specifically, no.
You know, the accountants are called bean counters.
Yeah. I know it's a logistical thing for the military, but I don't know where it comes from.
I dug around and tried to figure out where the term bean counters comes from. It comes from the fact that beans were traditionally used on the abacus.
Oh,
on strings
that
of
makes
little
sense.
Similarly sized beans, because they didn't have the capability of making the perfectly round balls we use today.
I had heard it in context of the French military when Napoleon was saying the army moves on its belly. But that yours seems quite reasonable.
They basically would count their beans up and down in their abaci. Yeah, I guess an abacus, a plural of abacus, seems to be abaci, but it's abacuses, which sounds vaguely profane. Anyway, the telephone number in here, which we haven't given out yet, is 254-773-1400. If today is January 4th, 2020, where you are, you're certainly welcome to give us a call. That's at 254-773-1400. Anything about the economy or anything else? By the way, since we're talking about markets, we were talking about markets, weren't we?
We were, yeah.
Okay. The Treasury yield, United States Treasury yield, is the bonds 10-year Treasury yield, is generally considered to be the symbol, the marker for the bond market's prediction for the next several years about what the economy is going to do. The stock market is also a prediction about what stock buyers think the economy is going to do, only it's much shorter term. And the stock market went up recently. It's gone up pretty well. But since the beginning of the year, for reasons I was unable to find discussed anywhere in financial literature, the Treasury yield has fallen consistently all both days of 2020 and that the market was open so far. And it fell fairly significantly compared with what it normally has been doing. And it's like the 10-year bond, Treasury bond, is forecasting that things are going to turn downhill, while the stock market still seems to think that they were going to have a great year to come and we're going to have much higher earnings and everything is going to be hunky-dory going forward. And so the debate goes on. Are the bond guys right, or are the stock guys right, or gals, or combination of the two?
Good question.
It's mostly guys.
We just got an email saying that our phones are down.
Ooh.
Checking all the switches in here, and they are in the correct position as far as I can tell. So
you can pick it up and check it. He's picking up and checking the phone. What's he got? What do you got?
No dial tone.
No dial tone.
Our phones are gone.
Well, so I guess you can't call in.
Send a telepathic message to 555-BRAIN.
Or you could...
Email us.
Email us.
Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. We had one email. But you lose your anonymity if you email in. You can't make fun of us without us knowing who you are.
I don't know. Some of the email addresses that we get email from... From which we get email. That's better English.
Well, you know, the
although it's legal now to put the
dangling participles are now considered okay.
But some of the email addresses from which we get emails are pretty anonymous. They're gobbledygook at gobbledygook.com, something like that. But you're certainly welcome to give us an email at either Jeff at tpwc.com or Jake at tpwc.com.
All right.
And we will try to respond. Do we get one yet?
We've gotten one just saying that the phone doesn't work. Nothing.
Well, that makes sense. Okay, the phone doesn't work. You want to discuss that?
I would like to talk about a few other things.
Really?
We're kind of wandering around, but the Secure Act is sort of kind of hitting the media's attention right now in a very low way. But we need to let people know what that is. If you're listening and you've never heard the word Secure Act before, then and you're an investor, you probably need to pay attention.
The first thing you need to know about the Secure Act is that it is a masterful machination of acronyms.
Yes.
Because
Secure has nothing to do with...
It doesn't increase security in any form or fashion.
No.
And it is, what did I say it was?
Setting up every community, it's setting every community up
for retirement enhancement.
Yeah. It doesn't make any sense. It has nothing really to do with what's in the bill. It's not community oriented. It's not setting up any communities to be retirement oriented. But it makes a good acronym. They should have just called it the Secure Act and forgotten that it was an acronym. That's my thought. It's frustrating because the Secure Act has nothing to do with what it's named. It has to do...
Is that false advertising?
I would say so, but Congress is allowed to do that.
Yeah, well, yeah.
I mean, that's how they got into office,
yeah.
Isn't it? False advertising is the name of the game in politics. So what is it? It's a new law, a new tax law. It is the biggest change to retirement tax planning and preparation since the Pension Protection Act of 2006.
Which nobody ever heard of either.
Well, except the people that are ultimate fans of ours who got goosebumps and said, "Ooh, that was thrilling. I loved that tax act."
Which they're still trying to figure out how to enact.
Yeah, that one has not fully been enacted. We still don't have a clear fiduciary standard for across labor and SEC guides. But coming forward to today, the Secure Act, which was signed into law on the 20th of December, makes some significant changes. And I'll start with the good news. How's that?
Let's lead with the good news first.
If you have not turned 70 and a half yet, or had not turned it before December 31st, semi-arbitrary deadline, then you don't have to take a required minimum distribution from your IRA or 401k until you're 72.
Presuming the law, but it all depends how young you are.
That's the point.
Because if it's a long ways out to 72, they could change the law three times between.
Right, that's true. That's true. But as the law stands today, now if you turned 70 and a half, man, that's an arbitrary way of calculating ages.
Well,
if
not
you
for
turned
an actuary.
70 and a half the day before on December 31st, you still have to take your required minimum distribution next year. If you turned it 10 minutes later after New Year's Eve, Happy New Year, the ball dropped, I turned 70 and a half. You don't have to take it till the year after you turn 72. So, what does that mean? It's good news for some people that didn't want to take the required minimum distribution. And we're just going to call them an RMD because that's what you're going to hear them called or read about them, an RMD, required minimum distribution. You get to delay that. That's good news.
Well, but then once you start taking it, they're higher.
Yeah.
The minimum is higher.
They also updated the life expectancy tables.
Right.
So the
you're officially authorized by the IRS to live longer now.
Yeah. So
And that's crucial.
The prior life expectancy tables were based in the year 2000 or 1998. So we've got some extra years added into there. We've had some dips in life expectancy in the last 2 years, but overall we're way up from then. So you'd have two things that are good news there. Well, why is it that you have to take required minimum distributions anyway? Why is it they're requiring you to take money out of an IRA or a 401k? And the answer to that is pretty simple.
Congress wants their taxes.
Yes. They allowed you to not pay taxes for a while. It's called deferred. You have deferred your taxes. Well, when you've deferred the taxes, there's some point where Congress wants to get paid.
This is when the deem comes in. It's the redeem.
Yes.
Congress is going to redeem their taxes.
Yes. So, and their bet is that over time, you've now got a lot more money in those tax-deferred positions than what you put in there. So they're going to get paid taxes on a larger amount. That's what they want. Now, the game that we play in planning is trying to figure out when's the appropriate time to defer your taxes, to deduct it from your income, and when's the appropriate time to take the taxes today, pay them, and then put it in a different kind of vehicle than a deductible vehicle. And it's a guesswork game. And it's a guesswork game on the part of Congress and the part of the planning profession. So they want to get paid.
Congress wants to get paid.
Right. How are they going to get paid?
Borrow money.
If they move the date that you're required to take money out back, that's like cutting taxes again. Well, they want to make sure that they have some revenue coming in. So this is not a revenue neutral bill. It's a revenue positive bill for the U.S. government. It means that they will receive more money in taxation because of this bill than if they hadn't done it. And it was, we started with the good news. In order to give up this tax money for a year and a half of not getting paid their part of your IRA, they said, here's what we're going to do. And what they're going to do is they're going to tax your beneficiaries. Your beneficiary used to, there's differing tax laws that affect this depending on when a person died. But if it's a non-spouse, so it's not your wife or your husband or your contracted partner, but someone else is receiving your assets when you die, and it's in an IRA. Up to January 1st, they had the right to take it out over their lifetime, or in some cases over, the remainder of your dead life expectancy, depending on who started taking out when and what time.
Which tells you that this is a phenomenally complex issue
and
it should not be attempted at home.
And it just got more complicated because now the heirs don't have their lifetime or your remaining dead lifetime to take the money out. They've got to take it out over 10 years, but there's no requirement to take it out in the first 9 years. So what that means is that most people are likely not to take it out unless they just liquidate the whole thing and pay and go crazy with it. Others are going to look at this and just get scared of the tax bill and say, I don't want to mess with it. I'll just leave it alone, kick the can down the road a little ways, and you get a massive tax bill in year 10 because you got to get the whole thing out. The penalty for not having it out is the same penalty as the RMD.
50%.
50% of what you were required to take out per year.
Which would make Congress very happy.
Yes, they will be very pleased with that.
And the IRS will send you thank you letters.
So what are the ramifications of this? If you are someone who's been working your whole life socking money away into a 401k to lower your taxes so that later on in life when you're pulling the money out, it'll be in a lower bracket. You were deducting it because you were at a high earner level. And now you're not. Now you're into retirement. You're not at a high earner level and you're able to take it out at that low. But you have a second goal. First, you want to use your retirement assets for your retirement. That's as it should be. You want to spend it. And if it goes to zero, it goes to zero. You won't like that. But secondary goal is handing off what remains to your heirs. To your beneficiaries.
Right.
Yeah. If that is a high priority goal for you, if it's an important thing for you to do that, You need to think about what tax bracket your beneficiaries are in now. Not your spouses. Spouses, it's treated like the same IRA. It's like their IRA now. Non-spousal beneficiaries have to take this stuff out over 10 years. And if you've been socking money away for your entire working life and you've been in a high income level, you might have millions of dollars in an IRA. If you just have a few heirs and you are giving that all to that heir, they have to...
Let me say this again. It's beneficiaries, not heirs.
I think that the title on an IRA is a beneficiary, but the beneficiary is an heir. They're an heir to your property. It is a generalized word.
Yeah.
Okay. So the technical word is beneficiary. You are right.
And the reason I say that is, and it's important to recognize that your IRA, when you die, does not pass through your will to your heirs.
Correct.
It passes to the listed beneficiaries on your IRA, and they may or may not be your heirs.
Well, they'll be your heirs, but they may not be the heir in your beneficiary or right. in your will.
Right.
Okay. So the person that receives this money in an IRA, it's still called either a beneficiary IRA or inherited IRA. You hear that heir
right.
in there. So it's an inherited IRA, beneficiary. There's no technical word for the name of the IRA when you receive it. Most companies have their own reason for calling it whatever. They call it a beneficiary IRA, a stretch IRA, an inherited IRA. You then have those 10 years, and if your beneficiaries are in a high income level and they have over $1 million coming to them and they have to split that out over the next 10 years, if they do it smartly, they're going to do it based on when they have less income or when they have upper income. Taking more or less, but in the end, they got to get it out by 10 years. So now the question is, if you are in that sweet spot, you have prepared, you have put your money in your 401k, now you're retired and you're taking money out, and you're in a lower income tax bracket, there's the next extremely complicated set of things, and we may be talking about doing a Roth conversion at that point. You pay taxes on more than your required amount to take out. To convert it over into a Roth, it's a complicated thing. I mean, it's not complicated step by step, but there's a lot of steps.
And it's important to recognize the tax code we're under and the tax law that we're under right now has lowered taxes at the end of 2017, actually, lowered taxes significantly. And I think there's a fairly high probability that I don't remember. When did the – was it 2027, which is not very far away.
For when the tax is in, it's 2025.
2025.
That when goes the taxes back to what it was before.
And I suspect, given the way we're running deficits right now, it's entirely possible that the tax rates will be even higher than they were before.
Right.
And so we're going through this window of relatively low taxation. And that should play in your income, obviously, generates the biggest difference in whether you're going to be in high tax or low tax bracket. But it's important to – it gets complicated at this point. You know, they really should call this – I know why they call it the Secure Act.
Because it's the Job Security Act for tax planners and professionals and for financial planners.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're very secure in our jobs now. This is not what I would prefer to be working on, but this gives us an opportunity to benefit clients. So it's an important thing. We've got a couple of emails since the phones are down. One of the emails here says, the subject is Wall Street Journal, January 2nd, article on Japan's lost 30 years. Article ends with a statement that Japan is what happens if we don't do structural reform. What reforms does the United States have to do to prevent this?
I got to answer to that one.
You go ahead. Talk about what the last 30 years means first.
Well, Japan 30 years ago was, a little over 30 years ago, was buying up big chunks of property in the United States. They were going through an economic boom, and they were just looked like they were going to dominate the world. As a matter of fact,
Back to the Future 2.
All about how the Japanese were now owned basically the United States. And from then, they slipped into a recession that lasted about 10 years. And they've gone about 30 years. Dang, gone. It seems strange they've gone 30 years. Anyway, they've gone about 30 years now with very low economic growth, trying to avoid deflation, actually they've had negative interest rates and negative inflation for a long time. But there's a really good reason for that. They never dealt and are still not dealing with the fact that most of their major banks were insolvent and long before the 2008-2009
crisis. It was in the 1990s. We had our savings and loan crisis. They had a banking crisis as well, and they didn't fix it. They didn't trash the banks that needed to be trashed and bail out the banks that needed to be bailed out.
So they got two major problems. Number one, they have zombie companies all through their economy that they've never allowed to fail. And they chose to fix this by building infrastructure reform. They were building infrastructure. They built highways and railroads.
Structural
everywhere.
Reform is what it says, not infrastructure.
Yeah, but the structural reform. So they didn't address the fact because that their banks are failing. Because very frankly, their culture won't allow them to because it would probably result in an awful lot of people committing suicide.
I'll give you some demographic statistics that I think you'll remember and smile about. In my childhood, there were drums of doom being played about the Japanese taking over the world economically, that they were a powerhouse. All you had to do is look at the statistics that they had 10 times as many engineers as they had attorneys. And that terrified us because innovation is taking place at the engineering level. These people are inventing things and making things. The problem is that in order for engineers to do that, they need to be secure in their pay and secure in the structural integrity of the system around them. When we created the Resolution Trust Corporation, this was a statistic, and I'm going to need to look it up. I remember it at the time in the professional rags, but I need to look it up again. I'm going to say it, but take it with a grain of salt because it sounds really good. There were more attorneys setting up the Resolution Trust Corporation. That's what we did in the United States to alleviate the savings and loans
than there
crisis.
Were attorneys in Japan.
Than there were attorneys
that
in Japan.
That is a true statement. I remember it.
So, well, it's true that it was stated. I did not verify it for myself.
I verified it at the time, and it was accurate.
So what that means is that we have a good balance in our innovation. We need to continue to do structural reform and allow banks to fail when they need to fail and keep certain banks that are too big from, one, being that big, and second, if we didn't prevent that part, from failing and knocking down a bunch of little banks.
Well, there's another demographic issue, since you were talking about demographics, that is crucial. Japan's population is shrinking and aging.
Correct.
We're not
Correct.
There yet, and we could get there if we halt enough immigration.
Yeah, that's where our growth is right now.
We would start to shrink and age the way Japan did, and Japanification would be a distinct possibility. It's happening in China.
Now, at the same time that we're saying that, that lost 30 years, I want you to know that the last 10 years of that has, at the individual level, not at the macro level, not all of Japan, but at the individual level in Japan, has improved.
Yes.
So how is it that splits? This is weird. People talk to me, you know, I say this, and I'm like, what do you mean? Japan as a whole is down, but the individuals are better.
There's fewer individuals.
Yeah. Their GDP is shrinking. Their overall income is shrinking, but it's shrinking slower than their population is. So each individual is making more money. Their production is fine per person, but the number of people is dropping.
And why do they have a number of people dropping? Because they're xenophobic.
Yeah, they don't want any immigration, and they're not that keen on replication either. They're not into the reproduction much.
There is a very, very high correlation between the financial prosperity of a nation and its birth rate. The higher the prosperity of a nation gets, the higher the average or the individual wealth gets, the fewer children they have because they can retire based on financial assets rather than retiring on biological assets.
Right.
Kids don't have to take care of them.
And it's not just that. I mean, right now we think old age, kids take care of us. But if you start reading economics books on agriculture, Adam Smith writes about this, about farmers that have kids because they need employees.
Right.
So they'd have a dozen kids so that they could work their farm and make it successful. And then they could have their retirement was just staying on the farm and the kids would take care of them.
It works for me.
Are you saying you're about to buy the farm? Ooh.
No, no. No, that was World War II where you bought the farm.
Right. So this concept of demographics, of we have a growing population, number one, when times get really good and we're an agricultural society with a lot of manual labor, your population will explode. If times are bad, the population shrinks, not because you're having less babies, but because they're not living as long. So come forward to a point where you're able to get good medical, where there are tools and machines that allow you to run the farm, and suddenly having children is an expense. And we've gone from a society here, not anywhere near as badly as in Japan.
Or in China.
That used to revere the elderly. In Japan, they had very, very clear and strict guidelines, ancestral laid down guidelines of respecting the elderly.
And supporting them.
And supporting them. That has flipped because now there's a lot more old people than young people. The society concentrates a lot more on the young than they do on the old. That's true across Europe. It's true in China. It's true in the United States to a lesser extent because we're having more kids still. We're still having 2.1 kids a couple, which is
the 0.1 is a little bit shaky, though.
Small growth rate. And if you ever see that 0.1 kid, what is that, a foot? This is our 0.1.
I don't know. When you first
statistically, it's hard.
When you first have a kid, it's less than a tenth the size of an adult.
Could so be that could be the they just one. Stay that size.
Yeah.
I don't know. So
we've been looking for that 0.1
right.
child.
Demographically, we still have reproduction growth in the United States. It's just very, very small. And overall, with immigration, we've averaged over the past decade about a 1% growth rate, which means that our population has been slowly getting younger. At the same time that the population of China as a whole, the population of Japan and of Europe, big chunks of Asia and Eastern Europe have been getting older at a high rate of speed.
Don't forget Russia.
Well, that was the Asia and Eastern Europe reference, is that Russia's population is shrinking very fast and they're aging very fast and their life expectancy is shrinking drastically. We can point at our life expectancy drops in the last couple of years and say this is the opioid epidemic. It's there, and we have a very, very small shrinking life expectancy over the last 2 years. In Russia, they have a drastically shrinking life expectancy, as in 5 to 10 years shrinkage over the last 20 years. And their culprit is vodka. And it's very, very clear. It's in all the medical journals in Russia that vodka is killing an entire generation and more. So is it just,
so Russia definitely has a lost generation.
Yeah. When we say lost 30 years in Japan, I'm not sure that if you lived in Japan, you would say that.
I don't think Japan has had a lost 30 years. What they did is they have not had massive international financial expansion over the last 30 years.
Right.
They have been basically trying to figure out how to deal with deflation and how to deal with a steady state economy. And we need to play some commercials because we've got to play commercials.
And we've got another question when we come back. It has to do less with economics and more with the current escalation of tensions in the Persian Gulf.
Do you feel your tension is escalating?
Yes.
But you're not in the Persian Gulf, so no. Right. Okay.
We'll be back on the other side of these commercials. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phones are not working, so you can't talk to us, but you can email us at jake@tpwc.com or jeff@tpwc.com, and we'll be back on the other side.
And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the phones are not working. Well, they're working, but they're not working. They're
Someone is saying that we don't have an active number. Have you ever seen an active number?
So hold still. Hold still.
Wait a minute. I think I have seen active numbers. Numbers in use would be active. But numbers that are imaginary probably would be inactive numbers.
I don't know. They're pretty active in my brain.
I don't know. Like a -5, is that an active number?
Imagination.
But it's only in your imagination. Of course, five exists because I can lift up a hand and there's five.
So. Uh-huh. Well, if you take those away, then that's negative five.
But it's not there.
All right.
So it's only imaginary.
Negative five is nothing.
So that would be an inactive number. Maybe that. Maybe we have, you know, those little dashes that you put in the middle of the telephone number?
Oh, maybe somebody's been using them as a minus sign instead. Oh, that'll do it.
That'll make an inactive number every time.
Maybe people will just need to put in the area code first, and then there'd be more numbers on the left side of the minus than on the right side.
So what was the question that the guy asked before the break?
What do you see happening with the current escalation of tensions in the Persian Gulf?
More of the same.
More semi-anarchy, more posturing.
It could result in Iran attacking the Saudi Arabian oil refinery.
Yeah. Or
no, they already did that. I'm sorry.
They are likely to attack some tankers in the... Wait, no.
They already did that.
They're doing that already.
I think what's happening... Could I answer that?
Sure.
There is an undeclared low-scale war between Iran and the United States underway.
It's been on for a while.
And they attack us through cyber attacks. We attack them through cyber attacks. What we're seeing with the elimination, let's just leave the political rhetoric out of it, the elimination of Soleimani.
Iranian general. We'll call him the Iranian general.
Yeah, Soleimani is more of what's been going on. Now, whether it's a violation of international laws or U.S. laws or something like that, we'll leave that to the lawyers and the judges to figure out if they're going to do it. The bottom line was this guy was the orchestrator of an active war around the world against U.S. interests, and he just got through orchestrating something that killed an American, so we killed him.
Yeah, he was the head of the Quds, and what is that? That's kind of like, we don't really have a direct comparison, but if you took this is an insult to the SEALs. I wouldn't.
No.
If you took
like
the head of our special forces.
Kind of the equivalent of the CIA's kind of secret army we had
right.
back in the 70s and 80s.
Right. And that's who this guy was. He's the head of that organization. He's the guy that was orchestrating what was happening outside of Iran by the Iranians.
And he has killed. There's very little disagreement among intelligence agencies or anybody else who's familiar with this issue that this guy is responsible for the death of hundreds and probably thousands of Americans. And he orchestrated it and planned it, and he didn't actually pull the trigger, but he was the guy behind it. And it was roughly from I'll be political for just a second here, my perspective, and I want to emphasize this is just my perspective. It's the equivalent of going after the head of Al-Qaeda or going after the head of ISIS. Somebody who has been who's the head of an organization that has been killing Americans.
Now, the diplomatic tensions here have more to do with the definition of a nation state. This is important. It sounds like I just completely shifted the subject. I didn't. Up to this point, when the United States refers to terrorism, they might say state sponsor of terrorism. They might say state funded terrorism. But terrorism is not a nation state. Terrorism is an organization that's out just to create terror. Iran is doing what it's doing. It's killing innocents, definitely, and it may be acting in a terrorizing way, but it's for the end goals of a nation state. Was it terrorism to bomb Pearl Harbor? Was it terrorism to bomb Nagasaki or Hiroshima? When we see a nation state do it, we say it's an attack because it is fulfilling the role of a nation state. What we're doing is kind of calling into question our recognition of Iran as a nation state.
Well, you know, several months ago, we officially declared the Quds organization and its parent organization, the Revolutionary Guard, as a terrorist organization.
Yeah.
So since he was the head of an element within a terrorist organization.
That's why we were allowed to do this, except that that whole process has said Iran is not a nation state anymore. And so that's part of this underlying kind of low-level war that's been going on between the United States and Iran. We're going to see more of it because Iran knows if they push us too hard, we're going to push back really hard. they're doing kind of little low-level jabs, and we've responded with an uppercut to the chin of one of their major organizations.
We did not respond when they shot down one of our drones in international water. Now, they claimed
almost
it wasn't.
Almost did, but we didn't do it.
But we decided not to. And we did not respond when they attacked one of our allies' refining operations. And the United States has declared that Saudi Arabia's integrity and security is of a national interest to the United States of America. And that's an international signal that if you attack Saudi Arabia, you've effectively attacked the United States of America. Just like President Carter did that for Kuwait and Saddam Hussein found out the hard way that that was a really bad idea.
No.
What?
Was not President Carter.
Was it Carter?
You just dated yourself.
Pretty sure that Carter declared Kuwait to be a national...
That was Bush, the first George H.W. Bush that invaded
it was before that.
Okay.
It was before that Carter actually declared that Kuwait, the security and safety of Kuwait was a vital national interest to the United States of America, which is a signal that if you invade Kuwait, we will attack you. And Saddam Hussein apparently missed that signal. We did, and that was our justification, by the way, for invading Kuwait, is that it was and I don't think that people overseas leadership get the message very clearly when we say this is a vital national interest to the United States of America.
Right.
And when we say that, that is a signal that if you attack this country, you've attacked us. And so there's a series of things that occurred. I personally think it was illegal taking out. I wouldn't even go so far as to call it assassination. I don't know that you'd call the killing of Osama bin Laden assassination, or Baghdadi, who was the head of ISIS, an assassination. It is simply the head of a terrorist organization gets killed because a terrorist organization is effectively at war with the United States. That's a little bit political. It's not a lot political, but the question was, what will it do? And the answer is not much. Psychologically, if Iran decided to go to full out war with the United States, which would be suicidal on their part, if they miscalculated, and people have in the past, Japan miscalculated totally.
Massively.
What would happen.
Yeah.
Germany miscalculated, what would happen if they went to war with the United States. And it wouldn't be the first time in history that Saddam Hussein miscalculated what would happen if he went to war with the United States. But neither of those had a huge negative impact on the market over the long term.
Right. None of that. So the tensions in the Middle East and Persian Gulf, there's a danger in even calling it the Persian Gulf. It's like calling the South China Sea the South China Sea. It implies that it's owned by Persia.
It isn't?
Persian Gulf. Iran is Persia, or Persia is Iran, and that concept of this is ours is what's allowing them to go out and say, let's attack these tankers. But yeah, that's tension that's going to be there for a while.
I think it's like a -5.
Unless we go in and flatten Iran or invade Iran, that would be a lot worse than invading Iraq was, because the terrain is completely different.
But
it'd be more like invading a really highly populated Afghanistan.
We could take
not a good thing.
Iran's military capabilities down pretty effectively. Now, would it be an easy thing? No. Would it put a complete end to the problem?
It
no.
It would just cause it to go on longer. This is an area of the world that's really good at staying angry. They've been doing it for many thousands of years. If we go in there and think that we can, you know, there's anger and unnaturally anarchistic movements happening in the Middle East, except that it's not unnatural if you look back throughout the entirety of human history, except for about a 30-year period. And even during that 30-year period, there were multiple conflicts that took place within it. So even the most stable that the Middle East has ever been has been unstable.
There was a very good article in the Wall Street Journal. I think it was Wall Street Journal today. I can't remember the name of it. I should be able to remember the name. Holman something. Jenkins, I think it was. And he made a very, very crucial economic point about the rising tensions in Southwest Asia. And I think it was a very, I think it's an important point because there was a time when this kind of activity, this kind of stress that would occur around the Persian Gulf, where 21 million barrels of oil, yeah, 21 million, maybe it was either 21 or 210 million, a lot of oil passes out through there to the rest of the world. And it would cause economic damage across the world if it were closed down by a war, which it has been in the past. It's not true anymore. The largest producer of oil in the world is no longer located on the Persian Gulf. It's located on the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah.
And we are that producer.
United States.
And because the shift of oil power has shifted to the United States,
it's less important of us to have stability there.
If the price of oil shoots up, it will be a kick in the butt, a positive kick in the butt to the United States.
Our economy does well.
Historically, oil spikes, and since we imported most of our oil, oil spikes were triggers for recession. Right now, an oil spike would be a trigger for an economic boom in the United States.
Yeah.
And so the price of oil didn't go up 25%. It only went up 5%. There's a major shift in the world that's gone on. It is different this time.
Well, it's different this time, except the principles are the same.
Right.
Who benefits by an oil spike? And before, Saudi Arabia would be profiting right up to when the...